On This Week in Enterprise Tech, your questions, our answers. It's our first Q&A. Quiet on the set.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for This Week in Enterprise Tech is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is TWiT, This Week in Enterprise Tech, episode 23, recorded December 17, 2012. Questions from the Trolls. This episode of TWiT is brought to you by RingCentral. We do everything in the cloud. That's why I love my cloud-based phone system, my RingCentral. Zero startup costs, and RingCentral is $20 per month per user. Try it now with a 30-day risk-free trial and buy one desk phone and get a second phone free, up to 20 phones. Call 800-543-9980 or visit ringcentral.com and use our promo code TWIT. And by Lantronics, maker of the XPrint server. Print from your iPad, iPhone, or any iOS device to virtually any printer. For more information, visit xprintserver.com/twit and enter the code HOLIDAY2012 to receive 20% off your order. And by Social Media Solutions from SAP. If you're a social media manager at a large enterprise, gain insight and engage in social media in a systematic way with Social Media Solutions from SAP. Learn more at sap.com/twit. Welcome to TWiT, This Week in Enterprise Tech. It's the show dedicated to the enterprise professional, the IT pro, and the geek who just wants to know how the world is connected. I'm your host, Father Robert Ballasaire. I'm the digital Jesuit, your guide to all things in the enterprise. And, you're here for our super special first ever question and answer episode. That's right, your questions, our answers. Joining me for Q&A is, as always, a distinguished panel of geeks and nerds, starting with Mr. Brian Chi, the nerd in paradise himself, the evangelist for Thin Links. Brian, what are you doing with that? What is that exactly?
I don't know.
you're feeling photographic. I like it. How is Hawaii? What's going on over there?
It's actually kind of rainy, which is typical for Christmas in Hawaii. One of the jewelry stores actually said, well, you know, anything bought between these 2 weeks, if it rains more than an inch on Christmas Day between midnight and 6 a.m., all your purchases are free. What a marketing ploy. Wow.
Absolutely. Well, you know, only in Hawaii. Also joining us is long time show lovable personality, Mr. Curtis Franklin from Enterprise Efficiency in Florida. Is it? We're still in Florida this time?
Today I'm back in Florida. Got home from Austin, Texas, and Dell World, where I spent last week. Get to spend a few days at home before heading out again. Ultimately, looking forward to CES in a couple of weeks. It's good to be in Florida for a few days.
Indeed, I just got back from Florida a week ago, and it was 75 degrees, which. Not bad, considering the fact that it's 40 here in D.C. right now. And I do believe there are some of our listeners who probably have less than that. So let's get to it. We're all about Q&A, and we've got 6 questions that were submitted to us on both our Reddit and our Twitter feed. We'd like to get to them, so let's start. The first one is submitted by Isting in Reddit, and he asks, what are some good ways to parse server logs? For example, the Windows Server Event Viewer filter is inadequate in log analysis. What are some good tools to make more sense of the logs in Windows and Linux? Now, I want to start this off because I've actually seen a great tool for looking at logs. It's called Splunk. We've been using it at Interop for the longest time. We actually knew Splunk before they did their IPO, when they were still in sort of the startup phase. They build their search engine off of Hadoop, And basically, it takes all the logs from all the different pieces of equipment that you may have in your network, and it makes it searchable. It makes it so that you can put in a string, just like you would in a search engine, to find specific events, to correlate specific events, to say, I only want to see events that involve this piece of equipment and this piece of equipment with this type of packet at this particular time with this particular external condition. It's a very powerful tool. And Brian, you've actually had experience with Splunk, right?
Yeah, actually, being the scientist and science support that I am, Splunk got looked at because it is more than just syslogs. It is time series data. One of the original descriptions is Google for time series data. And so for the Isting or Isting, however you pronounce that, it has a tool so that it'll actually pull the Windows logs and feed them correctly to Splunk. It's a little service it runs. And of course, you just send your syslog, standard syslog or syslog ng. Now, the cool thing is it's more than just indexing. There is a very, very rich language, you can see that on the screen, that allows you to take correlations, take relationships, and display them graphically on the screen so that you can see what the heck is going on. There's actually a school in the Midwest that's taking this data from a photovoltaic and wind generator and using Splunk to display it live. So you can get a free copy. Just download it from Splunk.com. They're going to ask you for permission to spam you, but that's all right. And that free version will handle, I believe, up to 500 meg of syslog per day, which sounds like a lot, but it's actually not, especially if you start cranking up the logging level on some of these things. But anyway, what's really cool about it is that it's got a really, really rich scripting language, so you can go crazy and manipulate it. We actually use it all the time at Interop. We're starting to use it for science. It's worth looking at.
Curtis, what's the word on syslogs? I remember being part of a podcast in which one of the engineers said, syslogs are the greatest tools that most network admins never look at. Because it's kind of inglorious. Yeah, every piece of gear that you own most likely creates some kind of log, and we don't use it. Why do you think that is?
Well, I think it has to do in almost every case with the sheer volume of data you get out of it. And logs are a great example of the difference between data and information. Data is raw. Data is a basic fact. And logs produce these basic facts by the bucket load. As a matter of fact, unless you know pretty much where and when to look, that can just be an insurmountable problem to go through all of them. That's why tools like Splunk, other tools from companies like ManageEngine are so important to be able to go in and automate the process of getting the data from all those logs, turn it into information, correlate that information, and put it into a form that actually helps the administrator figure out what's going on. Then if they need to really get into the details, they know precisely where to go look. It's a huge problem just in terms of the volume that has to be dealt with.
Right. I know. I absolutely agree. From my own experience, I know that the biggest problem is the fact that I can collect all the syslogs I have on my network, but unless I have a way to interpret them, that doesn't require me looking line by line by line through every single entry. It's completely useless. Chibert, I do want to throw back to you, though, and ask, in an environment, let's use Interop. So we've got a temporary network that's trying to essentially create up a miniature ISP. What kind of log data are we looking at? What kind of data will be coming in from the gear? What kind of data will we have to parse? So what would we be using Splunk for, and what kind of correlations can you think of that would be interesting?
Well, at its most simple, because we have so many different vendors that may or may not have done Interop before, one of the things we tend to do is search the Splunk database for who the heck used the show master password for their SNMP. that's on the most simple side. But more importantly, it allows us to say, okay, someone finally managed to make it across the floor and the problem occurred 3 hours ago. This gives us the ability to go and find out what things occurred. And if we need more data, then we'll go into something like the NetScout InfiniStream and roll back the protocol analysis log so we can actually watch the packets from 3 hours ago. It's kind of our interop time machine.
Right. Now, I do have to explain the reference because both of us laughed when you talked about who put it in the show password. We did have an interop a while back where during the show, suddenly all of our gear powered down. Everything in the colos downstairs, in the on the show floor, all around the classrooms. And we were frantically trying to figure out why did our network just turn itself off and turn it back on? Well, we start poking through the Splunk logs and we found out that someone had typed in the master password for all the power distribution units, essentially telling them to reset. Now, this person claimed that it wasn't him, but what we were able to do, because we were capturing all the syslogs, is we showed the exact time that the password was entered. We showed the exact terminal and port that the computer that was used to issue that was connected to, and we were able to capture the username and the password. So we knew exactly which person did it. That's the kind of value you get out of creative use of a search engine that lets you look through all those system logs and just type in something like password or password before power loss. Not bad. Any last words from either Curtis or Chiebert on creative uses of sysadmin logs?
Well, you know, just syslogs in general are one of those things that tend to go into the bit bucket all too often. And, you know, even if you're just holding on to them, just archive them, syslogs are absolutely necessary for cleaning up after the fact when you've got someone that's cheating or someone that's going through something as nasty as kiddie porn. Logs can make or break a lawsuit.
Curtis, you wanted to say something?
Yeah, I would just say that because syslogs are in a standard format, standard for each device, and because there's such large volumes of data, and because you can't actually hurt anything through the log file itself, they're great tools for learning how to do analysis and programming around data exploration. That's why I would recommend that anybody who's really interested in this go look at something like Graylog 2, which is an open source log management tool. Take it apart, figure out what you can do with it. You can build your own tools and learn a great deal about syslogs and what they can tell you in the process.
Last word from the chat room. We have Joel H. and Burnout. Yes, we did have one master password, and it was 1234. It's the same password we use at every interop. And who else was it? Oh, that's right. We do, Dave A., the best use of syslogs is to show them to people, let them get scared, and then blackmail them. Let's move on. Okay. So the next question, thank you very much. Actually, that was a great question. Thank you, Easting, for submitting that. The next one was given to us via email by a user who prefers to be called Il Postini, though I've never seen him in the chat room, so I'm assuming he just likes the NSFW hook. His question is, what are your preferred storage devices for portable, desktop, and network use? I want to start this off with my portable storage. I don't think this is a surprise. I use this. This is the IOSafe Rugged Portable. It's a little heavier than what you might expect from a standard portable hard drive. But for that heft, what you get is something that is almost a tank. It's armored. I've dropped this out of a car. I've set it on fire. I've dropped it into a pool. I've crushed it. I've even shot at it. And, it just keeps coming back for more. Now, you are going to pay a bit more for something like this because it is armored, but also because it includes what's called DRS, the drive recovery service. IOSafe, once you buy this drive and register it, will pay between $2,000 and $5,000 of their own money to recover data in case you ever lose it. And that's for any reason. It could be a mechanical failure. It could be it gets corrupted, or it could be that you accidentally deleted it and you now desperately want it back. It's a no questions asked guarantee. It's kind of like buying an insurance policy for your data. And in addition to the policy, you get just a nice piece of hardware. Also, in the zombie apocalypse, this can be used to crush a zombie head. Chibert, what do you got for mobile use?
Actually, I use the exact same thing. The only difference is that, no difference. You know, I use it on my MacBook Air, which is nice because the IOSafe Rugged Portable is also USB 3, so it's very fast. It's a great way to back up video. It's a great way to do Time Machine. And, you know, IOSafe and I have a long relationship. It's been an amazing product. My dean's office uses it to archive student records. My researchers are now starting to use it because we had this big flood about 5-6 years ago, and a whole bunch of researchers lost their data. I was actually poking around in the mud looking for servers that were buried in the muck. So IOSafe is now pretty standard here.
Yeah. It's one of these things that it sounds like it's expensive because it is, you know, it's twice to three times more expensive than a, you know, typical USB 3 drive in a plastic enclosure. But when you actually start thinking about how much the data costs, especially the data that's irreparable, like irreplaceable, like the data from science experiments, this actually is a bargain. Curtis, what do you got?
Well, from a travel perspective, my biggest form of data storage is the cloud. I make use of three public cloud services plus my own server that's reachable over FTP. And pretty much anything that I don't want solely on my laptop, or for that matter, solely on my tablet or my phone, gets synchronized up to typically two or three of these cloud or server devices. Now, on the desktop, I'll admit, I'm a big fan of big and cheap, something like the Western Digital Element. You can get a 2 terabyte drive for $100. I've got a pile of those, run things out there. And again, my big defense against failure is to have multiples. I'm much happier having critical, say, photo files, interview files, work files on at least two devices. And frankly, that's one of the reasons I like the cloud. I back up to the cloud as well as backing up to Time Machine. I like to have stuff in multiple physical locations. It just gives me that warm, fuzzy feeling deep down inside.
Brian, what do you got for the warm, fuzzy on the desktop?
Actually, for the desktop, I tend to actually use my Netgear. I'm real happy with the Netgear Ready NAS. But I actually will connect to the Ready NAS in IOSafe Solo so that I'll actually schedule a backup job so that NAS is backed up to the IOSafe. And my IOSafe is actually bolted down with an aircraft cable to the foundation of my home. And that way, God forbid, my home burns to the ground and the firemen are going crazy with those giant hoses. My IOSafe Solo is probably going to get bounced around a lot, but that's all right. I just don't want it going skittering off into the stream behind my home. So by nailing it down to the foundation, at least in the rubble of my home, I'm going to eventually be able to find my IOSafe Solo with my encrypted text files, with my family photos, videos, and so forth and so on. It's a nice warm and fuzzy.
I'm right with you. I actually use the same thing. This is an IOSafe Solo Pro. It's a boat anchor. This thing weighs about 30 pounds. But as you can see in the video, I mean, these things survive a whole lot of destruction. Again, this is probably the best demonstration you'll ever see at CES. If you ever get invited to an IOSafe demo, go. In the past couple of years, we've seen them set it on fire. We've shot at them. We've drilled at them. We even ran over one with a tractor. We've dropped them for 20 feet. We've, hosed them down like they would be if they were involved in a fire. This isn't being dropped from a tractor. And then taking the tractor and running over the top of it. It makes a nice little crunching sound whenever that happens. Now, again, the cool thing about this product is that it is also protected by the DRS, by the drive recovery service. So if for any reason, like you accidentally delete it or you run a tractor over your hard drive enclosure, they will actually sift through the debris and get your data back. Believe it or not, we were able to get back the data from this enclosure that you see on the screen right now. A tractor just ran over it. You see there's just powder. That powder is actually the ceramic that covers the hard drive so that when it's caught in a fire, that ceramic is embedded with water. The ceramic will actually ablate. The water will keep the hard drive cool enough so that it doesn't melt. And it also creates a positive pressure within the case. So it's venting outwards, which keeps smoke from coming into the enclosure. We were actually able to get this data back. We had to drill it out, but we got every single byte back. In fact, IOSafe has been going on, is it 4.5 years now, without ever losing data from one of their demonstrations. And that's saying something, because some of the demonstrations have gotten pretty extreme. I keep this hooked up. I have one on my desktop, which backs up files. I don't actually work off of it. I work off the SSDs on my desktop machine. And I've also got a couple of them hooked up to my ReadyNAS arrays in my data closet, which act as sort of indestructible storage partition. It's not a bad combination. I want to move on to the last part of the question, and that is, what do we do for network attached storage? Brian already mentioned this, but this is my number one. This is a Netgear ReadyNAS Pro. This is a 6-bay NAS. Now, this one actually contains all the files that I've used for TWiET. This is my TWiET array. So all those pre-produced segments, all the raw footage is contained on this array. Now, the nice thing about this is that it has dual 1 gigabit interfaces, which can be bonded. And I use that so that I can actually do the editing straight from the array. I don't have to download it to local. It's actually fast enough for me to do it over the network. I've also got a 4200, which is a rack mount unit that has 12 drives. I've got 24 terabytes in that. I've got a couple of those spread out throughout the country. And they provide all the heavy lifting across the network. One of the really cool things about the Netgear line, and the reason why I like this so much, is that if you've used the cheap one, the very entry-level ReadyNAS, it's got the same interface as the more expensive ones. So it's very easy to move up and down. They support X-RAID 2. You can hot swap drives. You can grow and shrink the partitions as necessary. I found it to pretty much be everything I need in a network attached array. Curtis, let's go to you. What do you got for network?
Well, on my network, I also have the same. I was just going over there taking a quick look. I have a ReadyNAS. I've got a small one compared to you guys. I think I've got 4 terabytes in mine. Here's the thing. Here in the office, we have typically put drives in servers. So the network attached device is used as a place basically for my lovely spouse and I to flip files back and forth if they're too big to shove them onto a thumb drive. It's a great box. It does a nice job of keeping things up and running fast enough for small office use. And it doesn't sound like a vacuum cleaner running behind my head all the time. So it meets all the basics. And when I tie it to the other kind of storage I use for mobile stuff, for being on the road, it gets the job done.
Yeah, that's actually one of the things that I like about the ReadyNAS, which I'm using for exercise right now. The Pro, actually, I've got two of them running right now in the main production desktop. You can barely hear them, whereas the 4200, which is designed to be in a data center, a data closet, you wouldn't want that running anywhere near an area that you want quiet. One of the other things I forgot to mention about the ReadyNAS series is when you do run out of space, because you will run out of space, you can replace each of the drives one by one with larger capacity drives. It will automatically fix it will redo the array, and then it will grow the array. So, for example, if I had 6 1-terabyte drives in here, I could pull them out one at a time, replace them with 4-terabyte drives, and instead of 6 terabytes of storage, I would have 24 terabytes of storage. Very nice system, very easy system to use. Chibert, back to you. What do you got for network?
I'm actually using a ReadyNAS 4200, and that's actually sitting on what is currently the world's largest Linux mirror site. 24 terabytes of Linux Mir goodness that we've made a commitment to the community that we're going to keep patches, upgrades, and distros online for at least 5 years. That is currently running at gig speeds, but I am I'm negotiating with my IT group to try and get a dedicated 10 gig pipe. So get this, 10 gig of Linux download. We're actually going through and harvesting the AS numbers from all the BGP domains on in Hawaii. And so if someone's going to do an update and they go to the mainland, the update system will actually turn them around and have them grab it locally from the University of Hawaii. So we've got a lot of stuff coming off. And by the way, apologies last week about the bandwidth. Apparently there was a Linux distro announcement and the downloads kind of went crazy and killed my bandwidth. So that's what that's why I looked like Lego Man last week.
One last word is that Netgear supposedly is getting me one of their brand new 5200s, which is a 12-bay array with dual 10-gig interfaces. I've got that all set up. I've got a place next to a couple of 10-gig switches that I'm going to blow traffic through. As soon as I get that, I'm going to let you play with it. Should be fun. Now, until we get there, I do want to talk about one of our sponsors, and that would be RingCentral. Now, if you've ever watched Twiat before, you've heard me talk about RingCentral, and that's just because we really like what they do. You see, when we built the new brick house, Leo decided that we didn't want to go with a bulky old PBX. He had seen them, he had experienced them, they just weren't for us. He didn't want to have a system that you had to maintain. He didn't want to have a lot of wires running every which way. And he didn't want to have a system that was so complicated that you really needed an engineer to come in anytime you wanted to do some major changes to a phone tree or your extension list. So when our IT guy, Russell, told us that we could have a phone system, a PBX powerful phone system that was in the cloud, well, it was a no-brainer. We decided to go with RingCentral because it means no clunky hardware down in our basement. It means that there's no startup cost. It means that there's no PBX hardware to install or maintain. RingCentral allows us to easily customize all of our call handling. Our producers get their voicemail and their email accounts, and we can get all of our fax messages on our smartphones. Now, RingCentral wants to be part of your business, and so they're offering all-inclusive pricing, as low as $20 per month per user. You can start right now with a 30-day risk-free trial, and they have a special offer for my listeners. When you buy one desk phone, you get a second desk phone free up to 20 phones. So, why wait? Call this number, designated for my listeners, 800-543-9980. That's 800-543-9980. Again, 800-543-9980. Or you can go to ringcentral.com and use the promo code TWIT. That's ringcentral.com, promo code TWIT. And we thank RingCentral for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Let's get on to the second segment of our Q&A. That comes from a user who goes by the name of TCPIP Freely. Nice. He asks, how does routing and peering work? And I figured that instead of having the three of us go around on the basics of routing, we just show you stuff, my IT guy says.
I'm Father Robert Balasair, the Digital Jesuit, host of Twiat, This Week in Enterprise Tech on the TWIT Network. We're here for another edition of Stuff My IT Guy Says. We're here at the Hot Stage Warehouse in Brisbane, California, assembling one of the most advanced temporary networks for the InteropNet. And I'm sitting next to Mr. Brandon Ross. Brandon, thank you very much for coming on.
Anytime.
Now, you've been a fixture of Interop. You've been doing our externals for as long back as I can remember. But for the folks at home, well, what's your background?
Yeah, so I've been working on the InteropNet network for nearly 20 years now, but when I'm not doing this, most of my career I've spent working for large service providers such as InterNAP, Comcast, and even way back in Mindsprint.
And what are you doing now?
So now I have a consulting company called Network Utility Force, providing the same kind of services to both service providers and enterprise.
So I think it's safe to say that you've been around the routing block a few times.
A little bit.
Okay. Now, that's what we're talking about. We're talking about routing. Because routing is still a little bit of black magic for a lot of people. I think most understand it's taking a packet of information or a few packets of information and pushing them from one router to the next. But most don't understand how it actually works. Tell me, what goes into routing?
So routing happens anytime that you or your device needs to send a packet off of your local area network. Your local area network would be your own Ethernet, either in your data center or maybe in your on your desktop or somewhere in your campus environment. So when you need to send your traffic off of that local network, it needs to look at the actual destination IP address of the packet as opposed to just the MAC address, which happens in switching.
Now, I can already hear the chat room yelling at me because we covered switching not too long ago, and I talked about how switches like this will keep a table of MAC addresses that are connected to them. And there's a process in which it gets handed from one switch to the next until it finds the appropriate device. And they're going to be asking, well, why can't we just use that for the internet? Why can't we use the exact same protocol, the exact same process to route as we do within our LAN?
So the answer is we tried that. Back in the old days when the internet was first coming together, there were some very large campus environments and even some wide area environments that were all switch-based. The problem is that it doesn't scale. You can't build arbitrarily large switch networks because you're depending only on the MAC address and a large, large MAC address table. You can imagine in your local device having to have every single MAC address for every device in the entire world in order to switch it.
That could take a while.
That could be a big problem.
Yeah. Okay. So that explains that. But now we have to get into routing. Now, I know that routing starts with a packet, but what are the important pieces of a packet? What do we need to know about?
So, at least as far as routing is concerned, you know, there's a lot of pieces of the packet that the applications use, but at least as far as routing is concerned, what's most important to us is the destination IP address and a field called time to live, or we call it TTL, which is a number that decrements each time that packet is routed.
Well, why would I want that?
So that's to keep loops from going on forever in the internet. So if you imagine that packet, you know, due to a misconfiguration, two routers think that the destination is pointing at each other, that packet's going to go back and forth multiple times. If there was no way to tell how many times you've done that so far, it would go on forever, and eventually all the bandwidth in the entire internet would be used up by one packet looping around forever.
Okay, so I've got my packet, I've got an origin, I've got a destination, I've got a TTL. What happens next?
Right. So when your local device determines that a packet it's about to send is not on your local network, it's going to send that packet to the default gateway or default router. Surely you've seen that configured in your servers and various devices over time. Once that packet reaches that router is then going to determine how to route that packet. So it's going to look at that destination IP address, and it's going to compare it against the routing table, which is just a list of all the destinations that router knows how to get to. Now, it's going to look for the most specific destination for that IP address. It's going to determine what we call it the next hop, what the local next place for that packet to go is, and it's going to re-encapsulate that packet in whatever frame needs to be transmitted. Most cases it's Ethernet, but it could be like a T3 or OC3 time division circuit. And then it's going to transmit that packet back out.
Well, how are those tables populated? I mean, those tables don't just magically appear. Someone actually has to create them so each router knows where to send it off, what direction to send it, so it gets to the next router and the next router and the next.
And that's a very good question, because in there is where all the complexity lies in routing and the parts of routing that people feel is difficult to comprehend. So there's basically two different areas of routing as far as route distribution goes. There's local route redistribution, like within your campus environment or within your enterprise, and then there's inter-domain routing. So we'll get to inter-domain in a second. The local routing, we use a protocol that's called an IGP, an interior gateway protocol, the most common of which is OSPF.
Okay.
So what OSPF does is it creates a database of all of the destinations in your network. And it has an algorithm whereby every single router in your network duplicates that exact same database from its point of view throughout the network. And that's how it distributes those routes around and ensures that there's a consistent list of routes throughout your network.
Okay, so that's good if I need to send packets within, say, a campus. But what happens if I need to go beyond that border, beyond the edge, as it were?
Right, and then we use an EGP, an exterior gateway protocol. And today, the only real EGP in use in the internet is called BGP, which is called Border Gateway Protocol. Essentially, BGP, as opposed to OSPF, instead of creating a single database that's shared by all routers, which you can imagine how big of a problem that would be if every router in the entire internet would have to have the exact same database, instead, it just transmits the best routes throughout the network, and from its perspective, right? So each router has a slightly different perspective of the entire internet, and so its routing table from a BGP perspective is going to be a little bit different.
Now, I've heard some controversy that people don't consider BGP a true routing protocol. Why is that?
So my junior engineers, I tell them a lot, I want you to repeat this 10 times. BGP is not an IGP. So it's kind of an obscure joke, maybe, but you're right in that BGP is not intended to tell every router across a path what the best route is, nor is it good at fast updates when topology changes happen. You still need something like OSPF underneath. So you can think of BGP as a route distribution protocol where it's spreading those routes across a large area of the network, but you still need something like OSPF in order to find specific destinations within your own, we call it an autonomous system, within your own network.
Okay. Now, of course, this is a lot of information to try to absorb in a short video. But I think one of the best places for them to find out about routing is to actually go to a networking conference. I say this all the time in these segments, and that is get out into the real world. Find some engineers who are actually deploying routes and talk to them. Ask them how they're doing it, how they're setting it up, and how it works for them. Or if they can, you know, why not drop by Interop? You can actually see Brandon and myself sitting in the NOC, both in Las Vegas and in New York. Now, I'm going to give you the last word here. What would you want to say to the CIO or the CTO? What is it that they need to understand about routing?
So the important thing is that certainly routing itself can be complex and can be difficult, but there are also simple configurations that you can build that are not necessarily that complex. Complexity is always the enemy of reliability. So you have to carefully balance the complexity versus the cost of deploying that routing protocol. So that's where experienced network engineers come in, is being able to balance how do you set up BGP, how much redundancy do you need in the network, how does your BGP protocol interact or not interact with your underlying local routing protocol, your IGP. So there's a lot of redundancy. There's a lot of techniques to make resiliency real without adding unnecessary complexity, and that's really the secret to designing and architecting a routed network.
So I'm going to summarize that. The bottom line is, find an expert. Brandon, thank you very much for coming on.
Absolutely.
Thank you for all the work you do with Interop, and you've wasted another 10 minutes. This has been Stuff My IT Guy Says, and remember, you've just been learned.
Before we go any further, I want to thank CyberDog, who's also in the chat room, for also submitting that question. It's a fantastic topic and one that we only barely scratched the surface of. Chibert, Curtis, is there anything that you think we need to cover that the video didn't? I mean, we know that IGP or OSPF is what you use within your campus network. So it's really good at discovering link state changes. It's really good at discovering topology changes. But as you go beyond the border, you move into EGP, Exterior Gateway Protocol, and you use something like Border Gateway Protocol so that you know just the best path rather than individual link states. Do we need to add anything?
Actually, I want to add something that one of the fastest and easiest ways to create a nice little routing lab in your office is just get an inexpensive managed layer 2 switch that can play the VLAN games and use VLANs, a whole bunch of VLANs on a single Ethernet interface for a Linux machine. And now you have a one-arm router. So it's a nice, fast, easy way to start tinkering with routing protocols. And there's a bunch of software out there like Route D and Zebra, where Zebra is actually kind of cool because it actually has a full implementation of ANSI standard iOS. I just repeat that, ANSI standard iOS. iOS does not belong to Cisco. Cisco has a proprietary version, but the American National Standards Institute does have a version of iOS, and that's what Zebra has implemented. So you can actually bring up a full-on router. In fact, at Interop many years ago, I believe it was 1999, we did a demonstration of multicast SSM, and we actually brought up Route D, and hardware routers were actually purposely crippled to not be able to do some advanced multicast routing. So we actually brought it up on Route D for our demonstration, and it worked beautifully. So Route D, Zebra, one arm routers, all good tools to learn routing.
Curtis, does Enterprise Efficiency have any good resources for those who are looking at, just learning how routing works?
You know, we have a little bit that's available. I would suggest that what people want to do primarily is go to our selection of white papers. If you look on our site, there is a section marked white papers. Now, to be brutally honest, most of what we do at Enterprise Efficiency is aimed at people who are managing, people who are making large purchase decisions rather than the people who are putting their hands on the devices. And this is one of those areas where I will very modestly say I have done a little bit, tiny bit of work with routing, just enough to know how very impressed I am with the people who can do serious playing with things like BGP. People like Brandon, I'm just in awe of their technical competence.
Once again, thanks to TCP/IP Freely and CyberDog for giving us that question, because routing is one of these topics that we need to know about because it forms the foundation of how we communicate today. And one of the things that we need to know in how we communicate today is how our message gets out. That's why I'm happy to have as a sponsor SAP and their social media solutions. Now, today, it's all about the brand. It's all about the message. It's all about how you present yourself to the people who are on the internet. The value of your brand is determined by the blogger who has a good or a bad experience about your service, or the Facebook post that touts your latest product, or the tweet that slams it. It's all about how you reply, and more than that, how you face the social world. That's where social media solutions from SAP comes into play. Now, there are two parts of their solution. The first part is the listening component. This is perhaps one of the most spectacular pieces of technology that exists today in responding to social media. You see, it uses natural language processing to actually tease out the meaning of messages it receives through social media. It can tell the difference between one sentence that may say, this product has never been good, and another that says, this product has never been this good. It can tease out interest. It can tease out the evaluations that people have by what they're doing. It actually looks at their patterns and lets you know when they're ready to buy. If you work in a social media department of a large enterprise, these things are all part of the challenge of staying on top of the conversation. And social media solutions from SAP helps you to do that. Not only does it help you to listen, but it helps you to build better products by incorporating real-time customer feedback into your innovation efforts. It helps you to identify customers who are ready to buy based on the buying signals that they're sending. And, it helps you to know what your brand is doing in the social realm. The second part of their service is the engaging component. It helps you improve customer support by allowing you to set rules about which messages to route to whom and how they should be dealt with. For example, if someone sends out a tweet frustrated with the level of service that your company has, it can automatically be routed to a customer service tech who will look up that person's account and try to get them help quickly and publicly. It's the way to get your message out to social media. Now, if you manage the social media presence for a large regional or national enterprise, you need to get in touch with SAP. They have the solutions that you'll need to manage your reputation, to manage your message, to manage your brand in the world of social media. You can find out more at sap.com/twit. and we thank SAP for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Let's get back to the Q&A with a question submitted by Nix is Fun, again from the Twiat Reddit page, who asks, what are the different types of firewall, IPS, IDS, that's intrusion prevention systems and intrusion detection, where do you place them within your network? Chibert, I want to hand this off to you because of the three of us, you've probably had the most experience with firewalls, IPS, and IDS.
Okay. Firewalls and such actually is not a simple answer. They come in different levels. For small to medium-sized businesses, I absolutely love UTMs, Unified Threat Management Appliances. Now, what makes them different from some of the roll-your-own firewalls is think of it as a hotel with lots and lots of rooms. Previously, you just had to lock the door. But now you have to leave doors open. You have to have things like servers. You have to have SSH. You have to have all kinds of different services that open. So in order to work with that, you actually have to have a way of watching the traffic, have a bouncer at the door, so to speak. And UTMs do that. So when I ran a big firewall test for InfoWorld magazine, one of the things that I actually did was say, hey, I have to have public servers. Let's go and run some simulated synthetic traffic through that. And let's see if it catches this subtle malware that's going back and forth. So I actually ran the entire cert library of attacks against firewalls. And one of the things that I actually did was I actually ran the attacks backwards as if someone had an infected laptop. And then what I did was I ran 2,000 VPN connections as if this was a regional corporation and then ran attacks against those. UTMs are great for catching things like that, and especially when you have an organization where you don't have a dedicated firewall person. Now, when you start getting into the big iron, the big enterprise, where you're starting to deal with tens of thousands of connections or hundreds or millions or tens of millions of connections coming through that firewall, that's when you start getting into needing some really, truly scalable systems where you start putting your IPS separate from your firewall, separate from your VPN appliances. And for those, you start getting into things like Checkpoint, McAfee, Nokia. Cisco's got their new ASA series. So when you ask the question about firewalls, it has to be in perspective. So I strongly recommend you write down your needs and your wants list. From that, your consultant can go and help you actually scale the system for you. I happen to be a really, really big fan of SonicWall because their systems scale madly. And when the lab needed to go from 100 meg to a gig, literally all I did was I backed up my old SonicWall 2040, throw it off onto my laptop, put in the new NSA E7500 and did a restore. And oh my God, it just went just bam. And it's caught all kinds of nastiness that's been trying to hit me. I'm a big stationary target, so I get lots and lots of attacks. My log actually dumps to my system 2 to 3 times a day. That's how much stuff tries to hit me.
Curtis, Chiba brings up a really good point, and that is, all too often, engineers get caught up in, I want to buy this box and I want to buy this box and I want this gear, rather than starting where they should start. And that is with, well, what do I need it to do? What are the services I need to provide? How much protection can I get away with? How much openness can I allow? On the enterprise efficiency side, since you are speaking mostly to CTOs and CIOs, how do they view firewall needs, IPS, IDS needs?
Often the protection needs, firewall, IDS, IPS, the full array, it's increasingly viewed through the filter of regulatory compliance. In other words, what do I have to be able not just to do, but to be able to prove that I'm doing in order to keep the regulators at bay? Because believe me, for most large IT executives, keeping the regulators at bay is at least as important as keeping the hackers at bay. The hackers can, in many cases, end up costing you far less money than the regulators. So looking at it through that lens, the regulatory compliance and compliance provability lens is critical. The other thing that they're going to want to do, when you ask them, what do we need to protect against? The knee-jerk answer is everything. And that is, in a very large part, why tools like the UTMs that Brian was talking about have become so important. It is possible to still put together a system using what we've always called best of breed solutions. But the fact is that integrating all of those best of breed solutions, and here's the critical part, making sure that there are no unintended interactions between them is awfully complicated. If you can pull all of that into one box, one system, then it makes things ultimately a lot cheaper, a lot easier, and a lot easier to prove from a compliance standpoint than doing it if you've got boxes, software, and systems spread all over the landscape.
You know, I really have nothing to add to that. You've touched on the hardware, you've touched on the methodology, and I think that's pretty much it. Thank you very much to Nix Is Fun for submitting that question. Let's move on to the next one, which was submitted by through email by someone who stole one of my jokes for his name, which is TTL equals zero. That's nice. I like that. And he has a very simple question. It is, how does SNMP, or that's Simple Network Management Protocol, work? Chibert, you're back. You're no longer Lego Man. We know that SNMP is a feature that's built into pretty much every piece of enterprise-class gear. It's a way to push out commands and configurations to the different gear that we may have across our network without having to go through the long, laborious process of either logging into a command line or into some sort of graphical user interface. But exactly how does SNMP work?
Think of it as get and put on a web server. It's not that too big a difference from your standard HTML and your web servers. But the cool thing that really makes SNMP different is, like XML, there's a schema that describes how to decode all this heavily encoded data. SNMP is light. It's very, very simple. But in order to get that lightweight protocol, they've heavily encoded. So the management information base, the MIBs, are the descriptors on how to decode that data. The other thing that's really, really cool about SNMP is that it's both get and put. You can make configuration changes. You can query what's going on with the switch. And you can also set triggers. So if some sort of special event, like a switch overheating, or maybe an uplink goes beyond a certain amount of bandwidth, you can actually automatically trigger these alerts and push the data out to your management console so you can find out what the heck is going on. If you aren't using SNMP, you really should be. It's cheap. It's simple. There's lots of things out there. Nagios is an amazingly good open source product that will do SNMP 1, 2, and 3. Just keep in mind, version 1 has no encryption, so you'd better be running it on an isolated network. Version 2 has at least a little bit. But version 3 is a full dual key encryption, and it allows you to install complete certificates so you could actually do management over a wide area network if you really needed to. Good stuff, not hard to set up, lots of tools out there, lots of corporations like HP, IBM, Dell all provide limited management consoles. There's really no reason why you shouldn't be running something. The University of Hawaii School of Ocean Earth Science and Technology, we actually use Science Logic. Thanks, guys. It's been a great product and wonderful.
I do want to, you talking about SNMP version 1 brings me back. We have a out-of-band management network at Interop, so we're essentially running two 10 gig or 1 gig rings, one for production and one for management. And one of the original reasons why we did that was because not only is it best practices, but we were using these APC UPSs that had these management cards that used version 1 of SNMP, completely clear text in the clear management. And you could sniff the show password just by sitting on the on one of the switches for a while. You were part of that, right? I mean, you were part of that decision making?
Oh, God, yeah. S&P V1 is great because it's there, and it's you can even put it into embedded systems really cheaply and easily. But clear text is a bad idea. So we actually run the SPY network, a completely isolated network, just for that type of thing. Access Ether is what we actually call it. And, just keep that away from prying eyes. It's all, putting that on your in-band is bad juju.
Curtis, I want to throw over to you. This is a lot like the question about logs, because when we're talking to admins, when we're talking to CTOs and executives, SNMP is another one of these topics that kind of gets ignored. It's a very powerful tool, but I don't typically see CTOs making SNMP part of their overall network deployment. Why is that?
Well, I think that a lot of CTOs aren't aware that they're making SNMP part of their deployment. The fact is that when you get down to the admin and architect level, as Brian says, virtually everyone is enabling SNMP on an enterprise network in order to be able to keep up, and if nothing else, to have those alerts pushed to a monitoring system. Now, here's where I think things get interesting. SNMP is turned on by default on a number of devices, and therefore it's very easy to have people in branch office, home office, small office situations who are spraying things like passwords around in clear text without being aware of it. So that's one of the reasons that people really need to be aware of this. It needs to be, if nothing else, on a checklist. Are we doing the right thing with SNMP? Should be a question that's always asked of your network administrators. The other thing is that this is another great tool. Even small routers, switches, various devices will tend to have SNMP capabilities. So if you're interested in learning about network diagnostics, it's a great thing to do to pick up one of these open source tools for looking at SNMP, play with configuring it. As long as you have some security on your network, you can do this without harm, and you can actually learn quite a bit about how the foundation for your network admin tools are put together.
I would just second that. I would say SNMP is one of these tools that you will be using at some point. You may not even know that you're using it. You may be using a graphical user interface that's sending the SNMP commands and traps for you. But the best way to learn it is to get a piece of gear. And pretty much every piece of gear from the last 20 years will have some form of this built into it. And just start playing with it. Start throwing commands at it. It doesn't even have to be on a production network. But just find out how it works, and you're going to find out how powerful it is to be able to manage your tools and your gear and your production switches remotely. Well, again, great question. Thank you very much to TTL equals zero. Now, I want to take one last chance to talk about one of our sponsors, and that's going to be Lantronics. Most of us have some of these devices. Even someone like me who's not big on iOS devices understands that the world is filled with devices like this. It's filled with the iPhone or with the iPad, with an iPod Touch, with iOS devices that have sort of redefined the way that we work. They've redefined how we transfer data back and forth to one another. But the question has always been, well, what happens when you have to take something that's on this device and print it? Well, there's been a couple of kludgy solutions. You could email it to yourself and print it from another computer. I've also seen people use dongles, USB dongles, on a jailbroken device so that they can download their document or their PDF and plug it straight into a printer. Now, you could also use a printer that has been enabled for use with iOS devices, but I mean, what, there's like a dozen of those. The better solution is to use this. This is the XPrint server from Lantronics, and it makes printing from any iOS device dead simple. Basically, the way that it works is you plug this into your network, and it automatically finds all the printers that your iPad, iPhone, or iPod Touch can print to. It eliminates the need to print through apps, install software, or email yourself documents, and it works with the USB or network printers that you already own, whether it's wired or wireless. The XPrint server prints directly from iOS. There are no apps to buy or software to load. It supports more than 4,000 of the most popular printers on the market. And setup is dead simple. I installed this probably in about 30 seconds just by plugging in the power and hooking it up to my network. The XPrint server automatically discovers the available printers and makes them usable by your iOS device. For the more advanced, and I love this feature, it also includes a configuration menu so that you can customize your XPrint server. It basically gives you both ends of the spectrum for administration. If you're just a user and you just want to make it work, just power it up and plug it in. But if you are a system administrator and you want to customize the way that your printers are seen on the network, it can do that too. A simple XPrint server supports multiple printers and virtually unlimited iOS devices. The Home Edition is $99 and supports up to 8 USB and 2 network printers, while the Network Edition is $199 and supports an unlimited number of network printers. It will even work with multifunction printers. So here's what I want you to do. I want you to go to xprintserver.com/twit for more information and to buy. And we've got a special offer for the month of December. If you use the code HOLIDAY2012, you will receive 20% off your order. That means the $199 edition becomes, well, $160. It means that the home edition becomes $80. Not bad. That's a little bit of ho-ho-ho for you. Remember, visit xprintserver.com/twit, and at checkout, enter the code HOLIDAY2012. And we thank Lantronics for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Let's get into the home stretch. It's the last segment of our question and answer episode. This one was submitted by user Loopback, who wants to know what goes into your daily toolkit. Curtis, let's start with you. What are the things that you typically carry around with you?
Well, I was looking at what goes into the little bag. And again, recognize that this is not something that I tend to carry with me if I'm, you know, running over to the mall to grab something from the food court. But I will carry a couple of thumb drives. One of them has Windows to go on it. One of them has Ubuntu. I'll carry a fistful of little thumb drives. And as a matter of fact, that's something I do carry with me. I carry about 128 gigs of storage on my keychain at all times. I'll tend to carry a Cat 6 patch cable with a crossover jack. There's a small bag that I carry that's got simple tools ranging from all kinds of drivers, screwdrivers, nut drivers, that sort of thing, pliers, a little propane soldering iron. I've got my old trusty DMM. It's actually a Radio Shack rebranded version of a Fluke multimeter that I carry with a bunch of different probes. Some shrink wrap tubing and a pocket knife. It's amazing what I can do with, oh, and a small flashlight. Give me all that, and there are all kinds of problems that I can solve. Although I will do one more thing. Something that is always in my toolkit is my cell phone, because that lets me do something that I did a couple of weeks ago, which was at about 8 o'clock at night when I was working on a friend's network, place a call to Hawaii and my friend Chibert and say, what on earth am I doing wrong? It was amazing. Just the act of describing to him what I was doing let me get it straight in my head, solve the problem, and got a network up and running for a couple of very nice older ladies, making them very happy with their connection to the internet.
I'm actually with you on that. There are very few problems in this world that cannot be solved with a call to Chibert. Speaking
That's
of Chibert,
one of my favorite rules.
Let's go over to you, Chibert. Hopefully you don't look like Lego Man again. What do you have in... Oh, there we go. That's what's in your tool bag. You want to explain all the pieces?
Yeah, this is an iFixit toolkit. This is the Pro. And it's got an amazing number of different types of tools and tips and so forth. There's not a whole lot of IT technology I can't fix with that. And for the networking stuff, I use this. This is actually a Bluetooth serial dongle. Macs don't have serial ports anymore, so I need some way of doing that. And to the guys at MetaGeeks, I don't leave home without it. This is actually a WiSpy DBX. It allows me to sniff the 8.5 5.8 gigahertz and 2.4 gigahertz range. And it has solved an amazing number of problems. And even if I'm going around and I don't have a machine, this is actually Windows to go on a stick. This is actually from Kensington. When you buy it, it actually comes with a demo copy of Windows 8. And then you just use your activation codes from whatever volume license agreement you have as a corporation. You stick that on. You literally boot from this USB 3 device. It works fine on USB 2. And it brings up a full Windows 8 machine, which is actually pretty snappy. It even goes and discovers what kind of hardware is on there. So if you have a touchscreen, it'll actually use the touchscreen. Very handy to have that. And because it's got some decent space on it, I can also go and throw some extra utilities. There's a lot of really cool things that I carry around. I drive TSA absolutely out of their mind. They always hit me for a hand inspect. And just to make life more interesting, I travel when I leave from Hawaii, I travel with a bag of Kentucky Fried Chicken. So I can always tell when my bag goes through the x-ray machine, it goes whoop, 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 whoop. And they're trying to figure out why there's a bag full of bones. Lots of fun.
So that's your bag of tools slash ways to tick off the TSA. I like that. You know, for me, it's a lot of the same things. You know, a lot of the basic tools. A screwdriver is always going to come in handy. A meter is going to always come in handy. And I think the MetaGeek DBX, that's probably been on the show the most out of any of the tools that we've had, just because it is so useful. If you've tried to ever troubleshoot a Wi-Fi problem without a decent tool, you know how frustrating it can be because you can't see the spectrum around you. With the DBX, you can. In my toolkit, it's got to start with this. This is an old device. I've had this for a long time, almost 10 years. This is a Fluke Networks Net tool. It looks really simple, and it is. It's run on a couple of batteries, but with this one tool, I can do everything from pinging gateways to cable testing. It's one of these universal tools that has been supplanted. You can't even buy this anymore unless you go to eBay, but there are plenty of tools like it from Fluke or from JDSU that do the same thing. I think something like this is essential to keep in your bag just because it comes handy in so many different circumstances. The other thing is, well, stuff like what you might carry. I have a lot of serial cables and USB adapters and barrel connectors and dongles, a USB Ethernet adapter, and the various converter cables that you might need to be out in the field. Essentially, like you, Chibert, I like to have the tools I might need at any given time. And that means I carry a full set of serial dongles so I can hook up to pretty much any gear that might be in the rack. Something that I think is unique to my kit is I always carry a power brick and, a HP IntelliJack. This says 3Com because they were bought by HP. The reason for that is because you will always have the need for PoE. PoE comes in very handy when you're in the field. And if you have an IntelliJack, it means that you're carrying with you a VLAN-capable switch that you know the configuration of. I'd say about 30% of the time when I go out into the field in a more advanced deployment, the problem is that the VLANs aren't playing nice with one another, or there's a misconfigured VLAN somewhere, and the services that are supposed to get to, say, a phone or to a Wi-Fi array aren't getting there. So it's always nice to have something like this that's in my bag that I know the configuration of and I know I can trust. Now, something that I know neither of you have in your kit and something that also drives the TSA crazy is this. I'm just going to say this is my key set. It's a skill that I learned a while back before I became a Jesuit. And essentially, this lets me get into any enclosure, any room, any colo that I need to get into. There are a lot of times when I will go out into the field and people have lost the keys for their enclosures, or they can't get into a particular room that has a run of fiber that I absolutely need to get to. And so with their permission, it's easy enough for me to get into a room or get into an enclosure within about 30 seconds. And that's without practicing. So, again, kind of unique. I don't know about a whole lot of network geeks who carry this around, but I find that it comes in handy. Anything you want to ask? Anything you guys want to add to your list of tools?
Padre, you said that you always get permission. It seems like you, of all people, should know the truth of the phrase that it's easier to gain forgiveness than permission.
Well, we have a thing in the church called presumed permission. That's really what I was talking about. I just presume I'm going to get position. It's like it's a time machine thing, basically. It's a Catholic time machine.
Yes, and I always go with rule number one from Leroy Jethro Gibbs. Always carry a knife.
Always carry a knife. He carries a knife. I carry a lockpick set. Let's go to the next question, the last question in our Q&A. And that was submitted by AKA Wook, again on our Twiat Reddit feed, who asks, I'm looking to start a career in IT. Where should I start? Could you recommend reliable information or conversation on the subject? Chibert, I know the first part of our answer is going to be the same, so let me turn this over to you. Young, aspiring engineer, he wants to get into IT. Where do you point him?
Well, I'm going to start off with one of my favorite sayings. The best network engineers are not the ones that know it all. They're the ones that know who to call. And so a lot of people in the chat room have asked me, why the heck do I have 3,700 contacts in my cell phone? And the answer is, I want to be able to call just about anyone. So the first part of this question is, I happen to think Interop is probably one of the best places to get started. You know, you get to talk to your peers. There's always some good birds of a feather sessions. There's some good classes. Now, for those of you that have taken the class 2 years in a row, notice it hasn't changed. Well, the topics don't change. The materials don't really change. It's just new people every year. So trade out, go to some of the other sessions. Start collecting business cards or scanning them or taking pictures of them. Start getting working with the community. I've been around in the computer industry since 1972, and I'm still calling some of my friends from the original ones. It's kind of funny when I'm at a Symantec session and Gordon Eubanks or someone like that is talking, and it's like, hi, Gordon. And it's always a pain in the ass for the bodyguards, but it's a lot of fun. Talk to friends, make friends, Facebook friends, Twitter friends. It's all about trying to get your community of friends and network of professionals to talk to each other and share their information, because most people will talk your ear off. Just look at me.
Curtis, let's go over to you with this angle. There's a lot of people out there who think that in order to get into IT, they have to get every cert under the sun. I think the three of us are not big fans of certs. Can I speak for all three of us there?
You can. You can.
You can.
In many ways, certs are, laziness tools for HR departments. I'm not saying that they are all useless. That's not true. There are some that are quite useful. But there are also a lot of them out there that exist simply to line the pockets of some cert organizations. Now, if I were telling someone, and I do get the question occasionally, you know, how to get into IT, one of the answers hasn't really changed, and that is, and this depends a bit on where you live, find a user group. There are Linux, Windows, Macintosh, SAP, Oracle, other user groups in virtually every town or city of any size. Start attending, because what you find there are people who have come together with the intention of sharing information. They will often be able to tell you not only what you actually need to learn, but they will be good resources as you learn it to provide information on companies that would be looking to hire someone with that level of knowledge. So I'm a big fan of user groups, and believe me, my experience with user groups goes back to the old DECUS or even the Boston Computer Society, and I can't recommend that human-to-human sharing of information highly enough.
Yeah. You know, I want to clear something up because there's a little bit of a flutter in the chat room. I'm not saying certs are worthless. I'm saying certs are almost worthless. No, seriously, though, I would not recommend that someone go to a cert program to learn about the craft. I think someone could go to a cert program once they know the craft and they want to have that little bit of papers to get them in the door in case they're actually actively competing for work. But in my experience, certs have been almost useless. But again, that's because I don't really have to prove myself to an HR department. The other thing is I am absolutely down with Chibert. That's the reason why I'm part of InterOp, to get the interaction with people who actually are in the industry. I remember the very first time I volunteered for InterOp, I sat down next to three gentlemen who I believe in aggregate were responsible for something like 20%, 30% of the white papers that power the technologies that are most responsible for the internet. And to be able to sit down and pick their brain and get honest answers about how the technology works, and then to actually put it into practice, to have someone say, this is how it should work. Oh, and by the way, boom, drops in front of you a big pile of gear. Go to it. There's no way to learn that's better than that. And, you know, when I have done hiring for IT jobs in the past, I've always looked for the person who has worked in the industry for a while, who has a good attitude, over the person with certs. Brian, Curtis, anything to add to that?
Actually, I'd like to chime in. I was actually one of the people that helped design the original certified Novell instructor program. Back in 1986, I went through and we actually, there was a cute story. The 10 distributors of Novell Netware in the in the world actually were joined together at a meeting with Ray Norda, the president of Novell, at Comdex. And old man Ingram, the original Ingram, as in Ingram Micro D distribution, basically said to everybody, I don't know about you folks, but I'm going to demand that I be able to teach NetWare in my distribution centers, or I'm going to stop selling NetWare. The 10 of us all agreed this was a good thing and proceeded to blackmail Ray Norda into providing the ability for the distribution centers to teach NetWare. So we actually have that. The original Novell certifications included a requirement for practicum, meaning you had to have X number of years, X number of projects under your belt. The American Management Systems, one of the big Beltway bandits, also EDS, Electronic Data Systems, the original Ross Perot Corporation, all required that you had practicum before you were turned over by yourself for a project. In fact, the original EDS contracts had you signing a $20,000 promissory note, and that promissory note would be knocked down as you got more and more seniority in the corporation. And after a period of about 3 years, it ended up with you running a project by yourself, and once the project was completed, the promissory note would be thrown away. Very cool way of doing things, and one of the reasons why the original EDS engineers were so consistently good. Strong proponent of practicums. I wish more four-year university degrees would bring them back.
Curtis, last words to you.
You know, one of the things, Brian just mentioned practicums, and one of the things I've seen from a number of companies in the industry is that they are looking for what amounts to a portfolio. So if you're really serious about getting into the IT business, go out there, get into the user groups, but start doing stuff. Put together a portfolio. Talk to us about how you have built your own network. Do programming. Build a portfolio of projects that you have programmed. Show up with a portfolio of the work you've done, and that's going to be the way you get into a company. That's the way you start your career. And as most people who've been in the industry any time will tell you, once you start the career, that's when you can really start learning.
Gentlemen, thank you very much for, having our very first Q&A episode of TWiET ever. You've used up another hour with TWiET, and as always, we want to thank our hosts, starting with Chibert. Chibert, what are the projects that you're working on? What do you think the TWiET audience needs to know about?
Sorry, Dell. I still say the Perk 300 is a terrible RAID controller. Don't stop selling it. Start at the Perk 700. Too many servers have died.
You are really obsessed with that server, aren't you?
Oh, man. I have now burned close to 150 hours rebuilding the same server because I've not been able to get the people to go and spend the money for a better RAID controller.
Nice. Okay, so Chibert will be in Hawaii slamming the top of a Dell server. Curtis, what about you? What's going on at Enterprise Efficiency?
Well, we are racing into the holiday season. We've got two episodes of E2 Radio, one tomorrow that's looking at disaster recovery, one on Thursday that's looking on system migration. Then we sort of idle back for the week between Christmas and New Year's. And in the New Year's, I'll be joining you and Chebert out at CES in Las Vegas. Looking forward to reporting from there. So appreciate everyone from the Twyatt audience who has joined us at E2. We really appreciate all of your input, your expertise, and being part of both communities. Believe me, the industry is better for you being part of the community.
Gentlemen, thank you again very much. Twyatt just wouldn't be the same without our favorite geeks. And thanks to you, our listeners and our watchers. The fact that you keep coming back means that we think there's a future for enterprise. It's not just for geeks anymore. It's for real life people. I also want to thank my producer, Karsten, and my super TD, Jason, who does all of this on the fly, learning as he goes. I mean, he's just incredible. Now, I do have a couple of appeals. The first one is to anyone who may be listening to this as a one-time download. Did you know that you can get this show delivered to your favorite devices automatically each week? That's right. If you go to twit.tv/Twyatt, you can find all the different methods to have the every episode of Twyatt delivered to your iPhone, to your iPad, to your iPod, to your Android device, to your tablet, to your Zune. Not only that, you can get multiple versions of each show so that you can listen to the audio file as you're jogging to work or driving. And then you can sit down in the evening with a loved one by a fire and watch Twyatt to your heart's delight. Also, if you go to thetechstop.net/Twyatt, you'll be able to find all of the show notes meticulously put together by CyberDog in our chat room, and also engage with our hosts so that you can find out what's coming up next, what's going on, what we'll be doing in a couple of weeks. You can also do that by going to my Twitter page at twitter.com/PadreSJ. If you follow, you'll be able to ask me for future topics of Twyatt, as well as comment on each and every single episode. Finally, Chebert, let me ask you a question. Did you know that we do this show live?
Live? I'm live? Really?
Oh, my God!
Thank you. Thank you. That was the response I was looking for. That's right. We are live every Monday at noon Pacific time, or 3 o'clock Eastern. We get together, a bunch of geeks who just love enterprise technology, and we do it live. And if you join us in the chat room at irc.twit.tv, you'll be able to meet all the same people that you just heard about in the Q&A show. That's CyberDog, that's TV's Egon, that's Curtis. Every single one of them is a genius and a troll all rolled up in one. And ain't that just cool? Finally, please come back week after week. Our next live episode will be January 14th, but we've got a doozy of an episode on January 7th. We'll be bringing you software-defined networking. This is actually our last episode for the new year. So to everyone celebrating, be safe, have fun, and take care. And remember, if you want to know what's going on in the enterprise, just keep Twyatt.